Okay, I think that we can start now this final session of the Principles of Banking course. Once again, I'm really very happy to have you, Olli-Pekka, here as our final sort of a keynote speaker
Good morning.
here in this course. And as I have already told you guys there in my last lecture this week, also this material that Olli-Pekka is going to be presenting here is going to be included to the material that's required for the exam. So please take care and let's do this organization of these questions and remarks so that you can send now questions because I'm sort of a supervisor of this session. You can send the questions also to the chat area there in Zoom if you have something that you want to ask from Olli-Pekka or give the questions after the session. So we will have a half an hour lunch break there after this first 90 minutes presentation and then continue from that. We will have a lunch break there for half an hour and then have the second session. But I will be recording these both sessions to a one file. So other than that, please, Olli-Pekka, you can introduce yourself in your first slides and I will switch off my camera so that we don't have these problems with the connection. Okay,
Okay.
happy to have you here.
Thanks. Thanks, Jeppe, and lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me to talk about very interesting aspects of banking. Hello, everybody. I will try now to switch to the slides, and let's see how that works. I have here share screen, and then we go. Now I ask, is this visible? Can you see?
Yeah, we can see it now. Yeah,
Okay,
thanks.
lovely, lovely.
Yeah,
Thanks,
good.
Jeppe. So we will spend together about 4 hours talking financial innovation, fintech, and shadow banking. But I will cover other grounds also because to understand the importance of financial innovation in financial sector, to understand why there has been this emergence of fintech, and also the phenomenal rise of the size of shadow banking, we need to understand the problems that the financial sector and finance introduces to decision makers. And also, we need to have a kind of idea of the proposed solutions for these problems that are kind of evident when we look at the financial intermediation. Please ask, interrupt also if you disagree. There is no kind of right answers about this. This is very active field of research at the moment, and also there is emerging so many new things that actually it's very, difficult for researchers to be in the forefront as the forefront is moving all the time. So that's why I would love to hear about your experiences also and your views about these items. And as Jeppe said, we will have first 90 minutes, and then we will close for a lunch break, and then we will continue. And actually, there is an additional subject also that I have now included into these lectures, and that's about climate change and financial sector and how financial sector is kind of responding to the problems of climate change. I think that's also important and kind of a new area that is good to kind of explore and to be acknowledged during these lectures. Okay, so just few words about myself. Why am I here talking? Why have Jeppe asked me to come here, which I'm very happy. Let's see whether I get this. Now the next problem is how to change the slides. Yeah, here, now it works. So yes, my name is Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen, and I'm an economist. At present, I'm working as a research director in PTT, which is the Pellervo Economic Research. And for you foreign participants, this doesn't tell you anything, but basically in almost all industrialized countries, there are a number of independent economic research institutions, which usually one is connected with labor movement, one is connected with employees and industry, and then actually we are a little bit like non kind of typical, because what we are, our affiliates are with the cooperative movement, like cooperative banks and mutual insurance companies, but also producer and consumer cooperatives. And as you know, Finland has a very sizable forest sector. So we have also this kind of forest industry as our member. I'm also an adjunct professor in insurance and banking in University of Vaasa, as you can see there in the low right corner. And I have been doing not only research, but have been very fortunate to have also kind of hands-on experience on financial sector. The most notable might be this CEO position in the Uganda Insurance Association in Africa, where I helped to build risk management capacity in Uganda for a number of years, and also building the knowledge capacity of the companies present in the Ugandan insurance market. And I actually have also kind of been one of the, I established the reinsurance company in the country that is actually doing very well at the moment. We felt that this kind of reinsurance capacity was missing, and we formed a company there, and it's now doing very well. So I don't know how many people have been, because these reinsurance companies are like big. So that's kind of, that was a very interesting experience. And at the moment also I'm a member of the board of Turva Insurance Company, which is located in Tampere. It's a smaller insurance company in Finland, but it's very interesting to be there and see how financial sector actually makes decisions, how the board boards think about strategy and stuff like that. So not only kind of like I have this academic experience, but I have this hands-on experience, and that's why it's really lovely to be here and discuss these things. And I would, as I said, I would really love to hear your views also of the matter. But let's go to the material. And I actually have selected a number of books which I would recommend. And because people come from various backgrounds, especially how sophisticated the mathematical abilities, because you can also come from a very kind of basic mathematical proficiency to study economics and business, and then you can be like really quant person. Therefore, I have like three levels here, which I can recommend. So the basic book in this field is, of course, Frederick Miskin's Economic of the Money, Banking and Financial Markets, which is the basic text. And then if you are kind of intermediate in math and kind of want to dwell a little bit more in, especially in banking, I would recommend this Matthew Kent's and John Thompson's The Economics of Banking. They are two British economists, and I have found that is kind of really, really good short introduction, in a sense that it's like maybe 300 pages, where this Miskin's book is like huge, as they usually are in the United States. They kind of load a lot of stuff into these basic introductory books. And then if you are really, really into math and these models, then you should pick up Xavier Freixas and Jean-Charles Rochette's The Microeconomics of Banking, which is really, it's an advanced text. So it's something that you are not supposed to kind of have yet as a proficiency. It's more kind of maybe late graduate studies, early kind of doctoral studies that you would kind of like have that that book as your kind of first choice. But these are the ones that you can pick whichever you feel comfortable with. And many of these things I talk about are found in these texts. But almost half what I cover is not included. They are a new developments in the market. So in that sense, this is mainly has to do with kind of introductory remarks. Let's talk about the role of financial markets in the economy, and that's a very interesting question. We can highlight a number of functions that the financial system takes care of in an economy, and one is of course that you need to move funds across time and space. You actually have the function that you pool funds from different actually sizes. Also, you pool funds from a number of different entities. And then the financial markets take very good care of managing risk and pricing these risks that are in the market. Then a very important function is, of course, extracting information. And most of the problems that we see in financial sector is these problems having to do with different levels of information that the market participants have. And we can also actually argue that because of these informational disparities between different market participants, there is the financial sector. It's a kind of one solution that has arisen for this informational asymmetry. And the fifth here is actually a result of this informational asymmetry, which are the two main types that we find. The other one is moral hazard, and asymmetric information is another one. I am certain that you have come across these two terms, not only in this kind of principles of banking, but also like a principles of economics courses. But just to say that the moral hazard means that after you make a contract or you start behaving opportunistically against the kind of principles on which this contract has been founded. I'm sorry. Actually, sorry. Nobody raised the hand. This is a good opportunity to show your kind of like proficiency, because of course it's not asymmetric information. It's addressing moral hazard and adverse selection. It's kind of came to my mind also that I have actually written this wrong. So it should be moral hazard and adverse selection, of course, not asymmetric information. So I'm sorry about this. I will, Jipe, correct this slide for the next round if you ask me.
Yeah, again. I know this the same thing, so I will be correcting. We have been discussing already about this, but it's good that you sort of go these through again.
So definitely my apologies. So of course the other one is adverse selection, which then means that before you make a contract, only those kind of types choose to have that contract that clearly doesn't kind of reflect the conditions on what the kind of contract was built upon. But those are the two ones, and sorry about that. And then, of course, very important is that you facilitate payment. Through the payment system, you facilitate kind of sale processes and stuff like that. So those are the main functions, which you, as Jipe said, have also gone through. But one of the kind of interesting features is that given these functions, which are very important, we have a theoretical kind of result from a very kind of like strong one from this Arrow-Debreu world. And this Arrow-Debreu world means full information, you know, no frictions, all the information available. which leads to this kind of basic kind of competitive equilibrium conditions. In that world, there should be no banks. Okay, so banks have no role in this kind of idealized kind of economy. So how is it that possible that we have theoretically kind of like the result that these banks are redundant, and then we have all these kind of like functions that are delivered by the financial sector? How do we kind of explain this? And of course, part of the explanation was also already given in the previous slide, but it's good that you understand that this is not the kind of like, this is the financial sector and banks are an answer to a number of problems that are not present in this kind of idealized world. So I don't want to go in a lot of details, and of course a lot of math is missing, but the point here is that if we kind of assume very idealized system where there are two time periods and, you know, one physical goods, and then there is like a consumers who also own stocks, there is a firm that produces, and then there is this bank that kind of take care of the of supplying the funds and also kind of like getting the funds in the economy. And in this case, there are like two assets. There are these deposits that are given as loans, and then there are securities which that these consumers hold. They own the firm and the bank, of course. And so they are perfect substitutes. And we assume a kind of profit maximization and also utility maximization. And there is a kind of market clearing conditions for kind of like rate of loans, rate for deposits, and also this kind of like rate for bonds. So what we have is that when these markets clear and there are no kind of differences, banks make zero profit, and like the composition of banks' balance sheet have no effect. Banks have kind of like no role in this economy. So this is the schema you can look at. As you can see, it's from this more advanced book by Freixas and Rochette. So implications are banks are redundant. In this kind of idealized economy, we wouldn't need banks. So how do we kind of solve this? How do we theoretically kind of justify the existence of banks? So there are the two main kind of like explanations, the ways out of this problem. And the other one is this incomplete markets paradigm, which actually says that there's a lot of this asymmetric information. There's a lot of uncertainty in the real life. So financial markets are not complete. You can't make kind of contracts over all state of the world, and therefore you can't be certain about the characteristics of not only borrowers but also the kind of depositors. So therefore there is a need for some kind of entity, and in this case it's banks, that actually collect and analyze this information and build products that kind of resolve some of these problems that this asymmetric information brings to the market. And then there is another one, which is this industrial organization's view, where you have these kind of different utilities and different needs for different kind of products. These banks kind of are established because you can do product differentiation. And by doing product differentiation, you can charge different prices from different kind of customers, and therefore there is room to make profit and then serve this kind of different needs of different customers. So these are like the two main proposed solutions for these problems. So coming back a little bit to the first slide of the functions, I still want to recap that, you know, by answering these kind of two paradigms, we can kind of like go deeper and look how kind of like banking sector financial intermediaries lower transaction costs. They do it by kind of providing these liquidity services. They are probably economies of scale, which is actually contested, whether a number of financial intermediaries have economics of scale effects. There is this kind of reduction of exposure to risk by this risk sharing, asset transformation, diversification, and there is this moral hazard and adverse selection, which we already talked about. Once again, to kind of look at the same type of problems from a little bit kind of different perspective, I have actually taken this from Mishkin, where there is like the problem, which here is adverse selection, and he kind of divides this moral hazard one that has to do with these equity contracts, and then to these debt contracts. You can look at that kind of like this adverse selection is a lot about kind of like how to kind of make right people, right customers, becoming your right persons to become or right entities becoming your customers. So you don't want to kind of risk prone ones to select into your kind of proposed menu of contracts, and then in this moral hazard type of situation, you try to kind of screen the qualities of these applicants, and then afterwards to structure the contracts in the way that it's very difficult for those that are your participants to act in a kind of self-interested way. It will become costly, so they will kind of abide by the rules. So those are the main kind of like ways of doing this also. So these were the kind of like we talked about now about the moral hazard, the adverse selection, and then how these come. I go a little bit here how that this has been kind of proposed, and now maybe a few words about how we can look at the banking as a kind of like a solution to a certain group's problems, the problems of certain kind of market participants as a kind of a group. So what's the problem that depositors, the people that put their money on the bank, what could be the kind of service that this bank could kind of offer them? And these are, as you can see, it goes way back to the 1980s, where these kind of first solutions or first kind of theoretical propositions were given. And this idea is that if you think yourself, you are now a student, but then you will become, you graduate and you get a job, and then you live through your life, but you never know when a shock might hit you, like you become ill or you become unemployed or something. So you have these liquidity shocks that will be kind of probably can happen, hopefully not to you. The idea in these models are that these liquidity shocks, you cannot kind of like make deals about it. So you don't know when you might become unemployed, so you can't make a contract on that. So banks actually then can kind of like collect the funds from all these individuals and then provide a liquidity service, an insurance against these idiosyncratic liquidity shocks, because one of the participants on this pool, like a person A, might get unemployed for a year in the first year, and then he would need this liquidity, and then the other person might become unemployed in year two, and then the third one might be employed for a year in year three. So by pooling them, you can kind of like not everybody needs to have this liquidity buffer, because that liquidity buffer is in this bank where you can kind of like then in the situation that you face these shocks, you can kind of get funding from there. So if they are not perfectly correlated, you know, there is a kind of the reserves that are tied in this insurance. This is basically an insurance scheme, is lower. So this would be an interest for people to why they would kind of deposit funds to a bank, and bank then would kind of insure them against these shocks. Well, what about the borrowers, those who want to finance their project? And then there is another, this is of course the other side of the banking, and this is a basic model originating from Diamond, where actually, there is a situation where these borrowers, the people that want to, or the firms who want to kind of get funds from the bank to finance their project, they have a better quality, how kind of high likely it is that these projects actually, you know, make money or, you know, do well. So the quality of the project is like only that the borrowers can kind of like know, and the bank cannot kind of get that information. So in order for banks to kind of, you know, get some kind of idea of the quality, one way would be that these entrepreneurs or firms or individuals can kind of signal their quality by going to the bank and saying, I believe this is such a kind of good project that I'm willing to put my money in there. So they will put the money where their mouth is, as there is a saying in English. But this signaling is costly because actually it's, if the project is high quality, then you wouldn't need in the situation where the bank would actually assess the quality of the project, you wouldn't need to put the money there. So then there is a possibility that all these borrowers go together and they form a bank and say, okay, this bank knows us well, so, you know, we get better financing conditions and we don't need to put so much collateral on this deal. So that's also a kind of another way of looking at it. And this actually feeds into this problem of that you kind of delegate the monitoring activities to the bank. So the idea here is that you kind of like, it's very costly to kind of monitor how these kind of, loans, how they perform, or how the funding that is offered, will the loan takers act as you have kind of like stipulated in the contract? If they don't, how do you kind of punish them? How do you earn it? If there's many kind of partners in this kind of loan syndicates and stuff, it's very, very high. So you kind of give that to the bank. You say that, okay, here's my money. You as a bank take care of loaning these funds, but also monitoring these loan takers for me. So there's an economics of scale in kind of like this monitoring activity. However, a very kind of like unfortunate side effect of this model is that actually, if the model is like, if the assumption is actually accurate, then we would only see one monopoly bank in the market. So that's something that this delegated monitoring kind of proposes, these economies of scale in monitoring. Okay, so another thing is that we were talking about banks and the existence of banks. So as we found from the earlier slide, where the implication of the model is that there should be just one bank in the market, not only are there like many banks, but there are also other financial intermediaries. And there is also a number of firms and also sometimes even individuals that are directly active in the financial market. So there is this kind of, there is not an intermediary. They directly are active, for example, in the stock market. They are directly active in debt markets. So how is that possible? Like, and one of the kind of theoretical kind of solutions proposed in number of kind of kind of papers is that contributions is that actually the firms, for example, they select to different types according to their characteristics. So some need to have these financial intermediaries they cannot access directly, and then there are some that can do that. And just to highlight four is that this kind of direct finance option is usually chosen by the firms that have high reputation. So if you have a good reputation, you don't need these financial intermediaries. You can access the for example, debt market by for example, rolling out bonds, issuing bonds, or then, you know, directly. Then you can have this, you know, those also are the ones that have highest level of collateral, so which are kind of very well financed by their kind of own equity. And then those that actually can kind of use the advanced technology and those that have like best credit rating. And then those smaller firms and those that kind of like are difficult to monitor or are too small to kind of audit all the aspects of them, or they have too costly to kind of you know, signal, then they will kind of revert to bank lending. So you have this kind of idea that the big firms and kind of big entities are there kind of directly working in the market, and then the smaller firms and the like households and customer and these kind of like individuals are there, they're having to go to via the kind of financial intermediary. In this case, banks. Well, given this fact that the financial sector is kind of answer to a number of inherent problems in an economic transactions, and also that there is this kind of need for finance, we can kind of ask, you know, given the structure of economy, what would be the optimal size of financial sector? So we have the real process of manufacturing, you know, consumption, everything. And then we have this kind of lubricate like oil in the sector. So how much kind of like this, what's the kind of proper size given the structure of the economy? So there has been some studies done they kind of conclude that if a financial sector kind of grows beyond a certain optimal size, which is to be determined, then it will actually kind of slow the growth of economy down by kind of like also employing resources which could be used in more productive ways and actually maybe kind of increasing like introducing other types of frictions in the market. So they have kind of like, there's an estimations that if we kind of measure the size of employment, it would be about 4%. But now, of course, digitalization makes this kind of like total employment estimation very difficult. You know, if we look, for example, to optimal amount of debt in the economy, these earlier contributions says it should be like 85 to 90% of the GDP, which is vastly lower than the situation is at the moment. And this actually has to do also with not only the financial sector, but then if we look at the shadow banking sector, which we will we will deal a little bit later. This is a good question, but financial services should be like services. They shouldn't be the driver of the economy. And this is the discussion of like the proper role. And these have actually been highlighted by the fact that you know, the enormous growth in financial sector, then these financial crises 2008, and how this kind of like deleveraging and kind of going back in the size of financial sector industry, and now again, you know, before Corona, like huge increase, and then now during the Corona also a little bit differently, of course, because it's central bank led, the kind of huge increase in the assets of the financial sector. Okay, this is the lengthy and kind of like many-sided introduction to this. But before we go to the banking as such, do you have any questions or comments you would like to kind of share? Maybe you have, Pekka, is there any kind of chat responses there?
No, there's nothing at the moment. So if you want to ask something, just open the microphone and ask from Oliver.
Well, if not, let's continue.
Yeah.
So now we deal a little bit, we go to the bank as such. We go like from this kind of economy and industry to the bank as a kind of business. And I find this very kind of illuminating, this Drake's and Rosett's definition that what is a bank? Because usually I at least, when I was younger, I thought of this differently in another way. But if we look at what is kind of the business of banks, so the business of banks is actually that they buy securities, which is they buy loans, and then they sell deposits. So they buy from these entrepreneurs and firms contracts, which they give money to them, which are the kind of loan contracts. And also they sell to the depositors, you know, these kind of deposit slips and collect money from them. And that's the kind of like the business model that the banks kind of, you know, engage themselves in. And this business introduces vital transformation functions. So there is this size transformation, which actually means that a lot of these depositors' deposits are small in size, especially the kind of households, and they recap them, they put them together, and they loan them as a bigger pots to these kind of like, or they buy from these bigger pools these loans, and then there is this maturity transformation, which we discussed about the role of banks in the deposits, the depositors' side, which is that mostly these depositors don't know when they need access to their kind of deposits because of these idiosyncratic risks, and usually the kind of like the day-to-day running of your affairs in a household means a kind of short-term maturity, but then, you know, these loans might run for tens of years, and the bank actually then is able to kind of do this maturity transformation. And of course, there is this risk transformation where a lot of high-risk projects by pooling together, you know, there's the diversification, and there the risk goes. The aggregate risk goes down, so there is this kind of risk transformation, which makes the kind of financing possible. Okay, so when we think that the bank's business is, as we showed in two slides ago, and they engage in transformational services, what about the situation where there is a lot of banks and they actually act in competition with each other? So how does competition actually show itself in financial services? And we know from the basic economics text that actually we think usually that competition is good. So when we have a lot of competition, you know, there's not possibility to kind of extract surpluses from consumers. And in a perfect case, you know, there is kind of no profits except the kind of a remuneration for the kind of for the capital, and then you know the consumer surplus is maximized. But in this case, we can actually quite legitimately ask, what about banking? Is it actually a good thing that banks compete with each other? And does that kind of competition that banks engage, is that kind of stability improving, or could it be in the, actually the case that it makes the economy more unstable? So this is very important, because this competition actually, of course, affects the profitability in a sense that if there is a lot of competition, you know that when we kind of go from the, you know, monopoly to monopolistic competition to kind of more towards pure competition, perfect competition, then, you know, we have this profitability of these entities going down. And this, of course, then might also affect the solvency of the banks. So if there is a competition, it usually means that some of the competitors won't make it. So what happens to the banks that, you know, can't compete very well? What happens to the depositors' money when they become insolvent? And of course, this competition also affects the observed market structure, which in this case is that you know, the concentration, how many banks there are in the market, and what are their size, how they are, the size distribution, is there big banks, small banks, all the banks at the same size, has of course effects. And then these have this macroeconomic effects, as we have seen. There is this spillover effects from the banking, that if the banking sector gets into the trouble, it means usually that the whole economy gets into trouble. Or if the economy has kind of like, the economy isn't working very well, you know, then, you know, the banks get into the trouble. So then there is this valid question, does this promote stability? And it has been shown that actually, you know, this non-price competition is the key issue here. And also the kind of like, how do you monitor and screen the risk-taking activity of the banks? So more competition can lead to an increased risk-taking in a sense that the bank managers have an incentive to kind of, if they have a lot of competitive pressure, they kind of have the incentive to take more risk-prone project, because those risk-prone project, if they succeed, bring in bigger returns, of course, because, you know, there is a trade-off between return and risk. You kind of tend to be more risk-prone. And you can also kind of think that as there has been this kind of, after a lot of banking crises, especially like the 1929 crisis, where a lot of banks went insolvent, the regulators introduced this deposit insurance, which is widely has been widely adopted in a number of jurisdictions. Well, this deposit insurance, which means that, you know, the deposits of the are guaranteed by the government or some kind of insurance system to up to a certain amount. It actually means that it's a put option for the management. It means you can take the risk, and if the risk doesn't pay off, you know, you become insolvent, the deposit insurance will fit the bill. So that actually kind of introduces even more risk taking here. And this, of course, then has an effect on the consumer welfare, in a sense that if you lose your money when the bank goes bust, well, your welfare certainly isn't kind of increased. So how can we we tame? How can we kind of control this excessive risk taking by the banks if actually by introducing competition, you kind of have this unfortunate side effects that by just acting rationally, acting like maximizing their own utility function, the bank managers take on too much risks. And one of the idea that has been proposed is that you should have this kind of charter value in the bank. So there should be something that the owners of the bank have a possibility of losing, in the sense that if the acting management takes too much risks, then the owners, who are actually the kind of principals of these bank managers, they lose something. So they have an incentive to build up contracts for the managers that tame this excessive risk. Well, the charter value could be thought of as an equity of a bank, but here it's actually the equal of the discounted value of this kind of future profits. And if you have a kind of perfect competition, then as we learned already, this, you know, future profits is equal to zero, and except of course the kind of remuneration for risk and then kind of, you know, the equity that is held in that kind of activity. But when kind of like there is possible barriers to entry, it's difficult to enter, or there is like an interest rate regulation or something, then you actually introduce profits into that sector. And when you introduce these profits by kind of diverging from the perfect competition case, then you build up charter value in this economy, in these banks, and then there is this possibility of losing something, and this will then kind of, you know, tame this risk taking. This charter value actually has two different situations depending on what we assume about the information in the market. So if there is a perfect information in the market, then, you know, it will condition the objectives of the bank manager so that they will actually choose minimal level of risk, because, you know, these owners can kind of like fully contract fully contract all the kind of outcomes in the future. And as there is a perfect risk, then the bank managers will choose minimal level risk. But you know, in the case of imperfect information, where you can't kind of see what the bank managers are doing, and you can't assess the riskiness of the projects they loan, then the bank chooses maximum level of risk. So one of the possibilities also is that the government, through the regulator, says that you actually have to have capital in your business. So if you have these capital requirements, then that means that there is this charter value in the banks. Or then the other one, which is the kind of solution to this perfect information requirement, is that you just, you know, make it mandatory for the bank to kind of tell everybody what's the risk level of their kind of businesses is. So those are two possibilities, that you actually mandate that there has to be kind of money in the game. And then the other one is that you mandate you know, these risk levels become public knowledge in a certain way, which also kind of then helps. And we can see from the actual regulation that these are actually two pillars. There is the kind of the capital requirements, and then there is the informational requirements. And interesting fact is that we will come to this relationship banking in a bit, which means that you tend to have a long customer relationships, you know, that also has been shown to kind of increase charter value and decrease risk taking. But we will come to that a little bit later. It talked about already about this monitoring and screening, but there is interesting kind of contributions in the literature where, you know, depending on how much information, what type of information, and in what level in the kind of in the kind of multi-divisional bank you have this kind of information available, and who does the monitoring has a big impact on the kind of the efficiency and the success of the kind of these activities, that also has an impact on who actually gets the loans. Now, is it like that the best borrowers are selected? We are again in this adverse selection situation where is it the best borrowers that will kind of select, will select. Will get selected to these low interest rate banks, or is it the kind of is there this adverse selection going on? Interestingly, is that if we start kind of going down on the kind of if we increase the competition in the banking sector by, for example, allowing new banks to enter in this kind of models, you usually then have that situation that the bad borrowers start getting credit, also loans, because, you know, these new entrants will come and they will kind of compete, and this will kind of introduce more riskiness on the kind of like financial sector. So one thing, and I don't know whether Juha-Pekka, you have talked about this, but one thing that I want to kind of kind of underline here is that financial sector is a different sort of kind of like from the other types of economic activity, in the sense that, you know, you tend to have a situation where there is actually a role for regulation. There is a role of kind of like not letting everybody in, establishing banks or becoming like active, so the logic goes a little bit differently given their kind of like this kind of specific features. Now we go a little bit to the relationship banking, and you might also kind of have discussed this before, but why do I kind of talk about this in an extent is that also this kind of shadow banking and the financial sector innovation and fintech is a kind of a new way of doing banking business. It introduced a lot of these new kind of like ways of structuring the customer relationship, and it heavily uses big data and artificial intelligence, all these kind of new kind of technological innovations. And this proposes a structural change from this typical old-fashioned relationship banking business. So you have to understand what is kind of like the relationship bank and what kind of solutions it offered and how this kind of new developments in banking kind of challenged this relationship banking. So therefore, we will discuss a little bit about this relationship banking. And as I said, it means that you deal repeatedly with the same customer. How is it possible that you deal repeatedly with the same customers? Well, there are two conditions, of course, that you have to be able to do long-term contracts. You have to have this the relationship banking comes when you can't make these long-term contracts, so contingent on different kind of characteristics in the market or outcomes in the market. So you have a lot of kind of non-contractable things that affect the outcomes in these kind of financing contracts. So that's one kind of requirement, because if you can make a contingent long-term contract where it says, if this happens, then this will happen. If this happens, then the contract is kind of adjusted in this way, then you don't need to have this kind of like a relationship banking. You just, you know, make a very extensive contract and then you forget the customer. And if this kind of happens, these kind of state of affairs that have been put on the contract, then you just kind of like somehow deal with it. And then the other one is that, that, of course, you have to kind of be able to discriminate between different customers. Well, what happens is that if this kind of relationship bank is the principal mode of operating, so you have a bank and you have this customer and you interact with the same customer for a long time, and you, by interacting with the same customer, you learn things about this customer. And you also learn not only the characteristics, but also where you're behaving. You know, is this a big high-risk customer? Is it this low-risk customer? Does this customer kind of like do what is kind of agreed, or does he kind of like act opportunistically? Is there this moral hazard and everything? And so the bank, by having the same customer from time period to the next, learns about the customer characteristics that can be used then to price the loans and the risk, inherent riskiness of these customers. Well, if there is this lock in effect, then the bank actually has information that none other bank has about this customer. So then that actually means that if the bank acts opportunistically, it can start using this informational advantage to harm the customer, to extract rents from this relationship. Because the customer cannot go to another bank, because the other bank doesn't know anything about this customer, does know very little. So if the customer is not happy with the current bank where he has this relationship, he can't go to another bank and tell, hey, I'm a great customer, you know, because you can't kind of verify that. Therefore, the customer is kind of locked into this situation, and the bank has a monopoly power. So then, you know, this leads actually to an inefficiency in the economy. And what are the proposed solutions for this? Well, you know, one solution is to have a kind of credit bureaus and kind of public credit registers where you, your kind of payment behavior and how good customer you are from a kind of a bank's viewpoint is somehow registered. So if you have done, if you have already always paid your bills in time, if you have a kind of, in the case of positive credit registers, which have also information about your income and you know how many loans you have from different entities, you can kind of shop around, because then the competitive bank can see, hey, this is a good customer, and offer a good rates to the customer. And then this relationship bank that has kind of screwed the customer loses that customer. So this is kind of like the way of having that relationship bank done. But we will get to into this, because then this has the idea that there's a lot of soft information. Soft information means this kind of like you have to kind of, in order to verify the customer, you have to physically kind of see how it, you cannot have a kind of easily verifiable information. And now this big data and this kind of like all this kind of new introductions and new technology makes it possible to kind of bypass this. A lot of soft information can be turned into a hard information, which means like quantified information, and they can be mined, and then, you know, this relationship banking that has kind of characterized the industry for a long time is kind of breaking down But we will come to that in the kind of the that area. Well, just, you know, this value chain where there is a lot of, you know, of course, components, and we could discuss a lot about this, but just to kind of, you know, have give you that idea. Do you have some questions, comments about relationship banking, you know, this competition and riskiness of the banks before we go to the shadow banking sector? Is there, Jipe, any chat?
No, they're still silent in chat. Nothing there. so
okay.
Carry on.
Okay, so now we go to the shadow banks. And you might have and probably have heard about that there is this enormous increase in the size of the shadow banks in the world. It's all shadow banking sector. And now the question is, what is this shadow bank? You know, what does that entail? And to give a kind of two proposed definitions, there is the one that has been proposed by Financial Stability Board, and it says that this is kind of credit intermediation that has a kind of that where, you know, the entities are, you know, outside the regular banking sector. So you have all this kind of new type of, you know, structured financial vehicles. You know, you have all this kind of like different ways of financing that you know, the regular banking system doesn't include in their offering. And then there is this Potsar, Howard University professor, who proposes that actually the way that shadow banks should be differentiated from the normal banks is not that they are kind of like outside the kind of regular banking system, because that's too kind of vague, but it should be termed to all these kind of financial intermediary liabilities that don't have this kind of guarantee by the official sector. We talked about this kind of deposit, you know, insurance type of act. So these are kind of all those fuzzy kind of contracts that if, you know, things go bad, then the official sector, whatever it is in different jurisdictions, don't kind of guarantee. So you tend up to lose everything. And why does these shadow banks exist? Well, there is an innovation, actually. There has been two proposals. There's this regulatory arbitrage, where you have a situation because of these financial crises, most notable recently 2008, the answer of the public sector was to kind of demand more capital, more kind of buffers to the financial sector in entities. So the capital requirements increased a lot, and that actually is, of course, costly, because if you have to put them, you know, the equity in or some other type of, you know, accepted buffer funds, then the cost of capital in these activities is, of course, rises, and the size of it. So there is an incentive then to kind of try to bypass this regulatory, you know, the entities in the regulatory sphere and kind of get better deals by kind of like operating in the area where there is not this kind of solvency or capital requirements. And then there's this innovation in composition of money, which is kind of like maybe a kind of not so transparent term. This would be all this kind of new payment systems, new kind of, you know, we know about the kind of blockchain technologies, you know, the way of kind of like structuring the lender and depositor type of contractual obligations, breaking down the kind of the value chains in these kind of finances and everything, and introducing new kind of entities there. Now, there is also a kind of a third kind of explanation coming out in the recent literature, which I don't have here, but I would want to mention. And this is actually the requirement for kind of safe assets and collateral. Now, there is this discussions that that actually one of the reasons the shadow banking emerged in United States is that in order to do kind of this lending to kind of this in order to securely do financing activities in the economy, you need to have collateral, because the collateral for these deals is something that makes it possible to transact these funds. And the growth of Chinese economy and actually the infrastructure in the Chinese economy, which is not kind of the property rights are not very well kind of like organized. There is a kind of like not a very high transparency. There was a lack of kind of collaterable assets in Chinese economy, and there was a big need for them because they needed to finance the growth. And one proposal is that this actually led in United States, which has a very high level of kind of like high legal infrastructure and very good jurisdictory system. Especially the housing assets of the United States were kind of transferred through these shadow banks to the collaterable assets in that would that help them to kind of fuel that could be used as a collateral for this kind of for the kind of investment funding in China. So this is one thing that is not here, but I would also kind of like to highlight that this collateral aspect of this kind of system has now become more kind of in the purview of economist researchers, looking at how does this collateral actually affect and what has been the needs, and could it be that the shadow bank has been a response to the needs of financing kind of growing economy and growing pool of investment that by normal banking sector has not been possible. Well, the features of the shadow banks is that they actually do this kind of, there's this lengthy networks. As I said, there is a kind of transformation of risk characteristics. Like if we go from this kind of, from this United States, housing assets through the special purpose vehicles, through the cutting of these pools of loans that has been, made a kind of financial instruments by deleveraging them from the asset sheet balance sheets of the banks to the kind of like to the kind of loadable kind of collaterable funds in the Chinese economy, just to kind of go back to the previous discussion. And then there is, very interestingly, there is usually in this kind of shadow banks, we think that they are somehow very separate from the normal banks, but there is usually this kind of implicit private guarantees. So a lot of like banks that are within the kind of regulatory framework, within the typical normal kind of market, the industry we consider financial kind of in the intermediation has this kind of links and kind of kind of backings of the shadow banking sector, and then there is and this actually introduces also this kind of indirect access to kind of official guarantees and everything, and one of the things is also this funding base. Which means that that these shadow banks usually collect funds not through the normal deposit taking institutions, but access the kind of funding base directly by kind of over the counter markets, like overnight deposits, short-term lending that is offered in the financial sector, but also individuals. And this is one of the going back to the Chinese economy again, one big feature in the shadow banks banking sector, where in China there it has a big role, is that the Chinese banks have been under the kind of deposit interest limit. So if you go to a normal bank, it used to be the case that you couldn't get a very high interest on your deposits. So the Chinese households try to find alternative ways of getting a little bit better return on their kind of savings. And these then went to these money market funds, which promised a very high interest rates in some cases. And these money markets fund then, bypassing the official kind of financial sector, funded Chinese companies in the local regional, especially like regional companies. So that was one of the big kind of like building block of the shadow banking sector in China. There is variety of entities here. Just these money market funds is here the fourth category, but there is these hedge funds. There are different type of finance companies. There is the special purpose vehicles. There is also kind of private equity and crowdfunding platforms. So, and more is coming. More kind of innovation is happening all the time in this kind of shadow banking sector. Well, how big this is? It has been tried. There is a kind of estimates by government, especially financial sector stability board, which is a kind of supranational entity, and in here we have actually the problem here with all these figures is that Corona did a lot of kind of like it mixed up a lot of these financial sector kind of data, and one can kind of argue, and Yipe, you have been researching these things, that how much is actually kind of a normal development and how much is a kind of corona induced development, and is it permanent or is it transitory? So that's why most of my figures is pre-corona time, just kind of in a hope that this is a kind of transitory phase, but maybe it's not. So maybe I have to kind of update them then with when it seems that these are permanent. But if we look at the a kind of like the size of the total global financial assets, it's of course huge. It's almost $400 trillion, and you can see that banking sector here has a kind of sizable has a kind of, it's almost like over the one third of it's over one third of the whole kind of system, and then there is of course big players are of course insurance companies, and if we look at the kind of public sector, then there's a central banks and public financial institutions. Then these others, the shadow banking sector here, has these other financial institutions, and already at the end of 2018, it's close to the getting into the same category as banks. So that's definitely a kind of, we are talking about almost as high. Well, and then of course there is this insurance corporations and pension funds that have been here also kind of like piped into this category. So where does these shadow banking assets reside? And it's interesting to see that most of them are actually in the EU, So if we take the whole, the total world world size of the assets, one third is in EU, one about one fourth is in United States, a little over, and then China is 10%. But of course, the size of these economies also are different. So you have to kind of think that that doesn't kind of like. Then you have to kind of compare that to the size of the economy underlying it. So in that sense, this is just the kind of like the division of these shadow banking assets in different jurisdictions. Well, what are the regulatory challenges with this type of players? Of course, there is this regulatory arbitrage, which I already highlighted as one of the main drivers for the birth of this. And we talked about how, for example, these Chinese households want to have a better return on their deposits, and therefore they kind of bypass the banks that have these kind of deposit rate ceilings. Then there is, and this of course proposes a big challenge for the regulators. And then there is this other is that it's actually very difficult to estimate the risks involved with the shadow banking sector. And there has been a proposal that lot of the risk is actually this kind of tail risk, which would be kind of like this kind of black swans type of risks, where you have a possibility of like very highly unlikely possibility, but for like really bad things happening. So there's like this tail, and then there's of course this kind of risk correlations that can kind of like, which are very difficult to estimate through different kind of copulas and stuff like that. And then there's these fragilities that as the kind of like this finance has been, the value chain has been broken to number of very kind of thin kind of areas. Then, of course, if one kind of block from this funding kind of value chain somehow gets into the trouble, then you know it tends to be very fragile in the sense that then it spills over to the other areas and it can cause a total breakdown. Then there's this leverage cycles, which of course you know that when you know things look good, then all the asset values get increased, and if the asset values get increased, then you tend to kind of be able to take more leverage on those, and then it has this kind of virtual cycle. But when things go bad, then you know the kind of asset values go down, and the possibility to be used as a collateral go down, and then you know you have this kind of bad cycle where you know kind of it leads to the contraction of finance. And we talked about agency problems even in the case of a normal kind of bank. You can imagine what kind of agency problems there are in this kind of highly decentralized, highly kind of overlapped and kind of fragmentary fragile system. So all these are the regulatory challenges involved with shadow banks. We are now going to actually, these were all the kind of background. We talked about the banking sector. Why do we have that kind of sector in the economy? We talked about shadow banking, what has been the kind of its growth, it has been big, and what type of problems does it have? And these two types actually feed into each other, that we kind of see that the shadow banking has been partly created by the possibilities of financial innovation and also kind of regulatory officials' inability to kind of cope with this kind of financial innovation. And then we will talk about kind of how these fintech firms have been enablers of this kind of, not only the kind of like financial innovation and you know, kind of increased activity in the kind of research and development in the kind of different banking products and different financial instruments, but also kind of you know, they have been the possibility for banks to kind of outsource their kind of risk-taking activities and such. And then we will actually go also to these climate change things, and also then to problems of regulation. How do we regulate, you know, financial innovation? Should we regulate it? And also, what is the kind of like the regulator's response to these kind of fintech firms? And we close by that. So is there any questions before we kind of jump from the kind of setting the scene into the kind of, you know, this new area? So do you have any questions on that? Or Juha-Pekka, do you have any comments or questions?
No, thanks for this part, Olli-Pekka. There seems to be no questions in the audience. And actually, the things that you have covered here, you had lots of new sort of ideas and new perspectives of the things. Some of the things were already familiar to the students, but lots of new things also. It's a really good addition here. But do you want to still continue now, or would you like to have the lunch break now? Or
yeah, actually, what I would suggest that as there is like 10 minutes, we could like break now, because this will then, you know, when I go to finance innovation, we will kind of have to kind of break off in the middle of these things. So maybe it's also better for you that you get this kind of in a one kind of block.
Yeah.
So if it's is it okay for the audience that we have now the half an hour break?
It seems no one is arguing against that. So let's have a half an hour break now and continue 10 past 12.
Okay, lovely. Okay. We do that. Okay, okay, lovely. Thanks so much.
Thanks. See you.
Okay, take care.
Okay, welcome back to the second part of Olli-Pekka's lecture. So, okay, we can continue directly, please.
Okay, lovely. Thanks so much, JP. And I hope, has there been now during the break, have you come up with any questions or comments or anything related to the first part? Because now it would be maybe a good time to address those.
No, there's nothing, at least in the chat.
Okay. So maybe we continue and we will now go to this kind of financial innovation and fintech part of the of this presentation, and it's very interesting that such a development has occurred. Traditionally, it was viewed that the financial services was kind of like a little bit conservative and area, but now there has been a enormous growth in activities related to, you know, development of the sector, new product offering, new value propositions, new entities and players. And now during this lecture, I would like to try to kind of put this in the bigger perspective, where we will look at the kind of innovation and especially how it kind of relates to financial sector, and then to the fintechs, which are the kind of the new startups that are kind of like doing a lot of this disruption that is happening in the financial sectors, and then we go to this climate change, what kind of challenges it poses, and then the regulatory issues, and that's about the area I'm trying to cover now in this next 5 minutes. And please don't hesitate to interrupt or kind of challenge me. That would be great. And Jipe is looking at the chat box, so you can also have questions there. Well, to start, we need to somehow to define what is what do we mean by financial innovation? And Peter Tufano, the professor in Harvard University, has proposed a definition that says that financial innovation is the act of creating and popularizing new financial instruments, technologies, institutions, and markets. So this is a very large, wide kind of definition, because it doesn't only include these instruments, but it also kind of like proposes that we can, by innovating in financial sector, we can even create new financial markets, new financial institutions. So the kind of definition leaves a lot of ground for kind of looking at the different aspects. Now, we started this lecture in the morning by looking at the different functions that financial intermediation fulfills in the economy. And if we look at kind of like what innovation does in finance, it actually links quite one-to-one, maps quite one-to-one into those activities. So there's financial innovations that try to kind of complete these incomplete markets, try to find the products that makes it possible to make financial contracts in areas where there wasn't possibility before, both like spatially and temporarily. And of course, there is this trying to kind of to solve these agency concerns and these asymmetric information problems, the moral hazard and adverse selection problems that we discussed during the first part of the lecture. The innovation also exists in trying to kind of minimize these transaction search or marketing costs. And this has been, of course, due to the digitalization. This has been a big area where there has been a lot of new things happening, especially because big data and use of machine learning technologies and artificial intelligence has been very easy to create products and offerings in this kind of transaction and search and marketing type of activities. Well, we talked about the regulatory arbitrage. So, you know, innovation can also try to kind of bypass regulation or to make it easier for the financial sector entities to comply with regulation. There is an area of fintech that is called RegTech, regulatory technologies, which just tries to do this. It tries to make it easier for banks to kind of manage the ever-increasing regulatory burdens they face, and especially like regulatory reporting requirements. Then there's also, unfortunately, this area where the innovation actually attempts to kind of avoid taxes or minimize the tax burden of the financial sector players. Then there is an area of innovation that has to do with payment, especially like payment transfer between countries. So like increasing globalization, trade-related kind of like financial flows is one area. So there is a lot of kind of fintech firms offering ways to make it easier for kind of small firms to kind of take care of the kind of the trading between different areas, and of course there's then this risk motivative innovation where you try to for example find innovative risk management processes, and then innovation also heavily builds on these technological shocks. One of such would be the kind of the growth of like character recognition, visual kind of AI, the visualization technology stuff, to give the kind of latest where the kind of there is a lot of development. Now, why this in the rise of innovative activities in financial sector? Why has it risen now? And of course, you know, if you look at the financial sector and banks, all products are basically digital. Most of the information is available digitally. The contracts can be kind of like, which are usually some kind of contracts, can be digitalized, so and they can be very easily distributed. By digitalizing processes, it's very easy to achieve cost efficiency. And also a lot of external effects on harnessing this digitalized process information that is generated. Then there is a kind of customers' willingness to buy through digital channels, and this has of course been increased by the pandemic that is still unfortunately going on. So by these lockdowns, the customers have been kind of forced to do their kind of like purchasing activities do through the digital means. And of course, then, you know, there is a kind of like increasing area of possible competitors that use these digital offerings, not only in the kind of financial sector itself, but also kind of like this kind of big data and kind of, you know, platform type of players that used to not to be there. There has been a kind of criticism that financial innovation is difficult in finance, that there is a kind of certain features in the market and in the structure of the market that's why we used to kind of quite some time to kind of look at the one kind of like the underlying processes in the first part that could kind of explain why there are these kind of financial services, to kind of understand what are the problems connected with it. And one of the kind of like issue raised is that, you know, the banks are very risk avoid. They don't want to take a lot of risks. The regulatory emphasis is on security and solvency and not kind of like innovating new products that which risk profiles are unknown or that might backfire in some times, and that makes the kind of the whole industry quite conservative in its outlook. One of the interesting features is that actually it's quite difficult to project intellectual property in financial sector. Because you know, these are basically intangible products that are kind of like that get their kind of physical appearance in these contracts. So this is usually not the type of intellectual property that can be patented. There is very little kind of brand at the stuff of kind of things that you would even have a kind of leisure intellectual property property development. That this means that, as we know from the basic economics, that there is this externality that if you come up with a great product, soon everybody can copy it because it's very difficult to enforce your property rights or guarantee kind of like some kind of a copyright on that, and therefore nobody has a big incentive to kind of do the innovation, because you know that you can't kind of internalize the benefits, you only internalize the costs. And then there has been a discuss that for example, there is certain, this is not directly to the banks, but of course there is a lot of bank products that have this kind of insurance related features or are offered as a part of financial conglomerates, where there is also insurance arms, or although they are kind of like separate, and there's certain limits to insurability. And of course, these kind of limits are now, because of the digitalization, because of the huge increase in volume of data and the huge increase in the computing capacity, the limits of insurability is kind of like enlarging, but there still is limits on both what can be insured and what are the kind of requirements for this kind of operating insurance products. And this limits the possibility to have a kind of like very path-breaking innovations in that area also. Then, there's also this proposal that people are actually not very financially literate, and that's why they don't know what they want. So there's this lack of demand, and the, in order to kind of introduce new products or new ways of taking care of your kind of financial affairs is very costly and difficult, and therefore companies don't want that, banks don't want to do it. However, there is now this kind of financial literacy movement, which has been actually created by central banks in their initiatives. There is like a national financial literacy strategies coming up and everything. So that also is kind of like, being made more lucrative by this by kind of enlarging the pools of cooperation. The data limitations here actually has to do with the kind of GDPR, like data protect individual data protection legislation, where although you would have a lot of data about the customers, there is a data protection regulation that makes it difficult to kind of harness or combine different data sets, and also the way do you have the right to kind of mine the data, and of course there's this other types of risks, but basically these are the kind of like the walls within which the kind of financial sector innovation can happen.
Olli-Pekka, there's actually now a very good question. Perhaps it's worthwhile to ask it from you, because Chayani would like to know that what is actually the difference between the shadow bank and non-fintech shadow bank?
Shadow bank and non-fintech
yeah. Shadow bank.
Okay, that's a very good question. Shadow banks have other entities besides fintech firms. As you saw that, in this kind of like very very wide definition that the Financial Stability Board uses, there's also like kind of pension funds and insurance companies that are sometimes calculated as part of this kind of shadow banking sector. So you can have a kind of fintech firms that you have in a shadow banking sector, players that wouldn't be considered fintech firms.
Yeah.
But there's also, but I would say that many fintech firms that engage in kind of payment systems and asset transformation and such, they would clearly be considered as shadow banking sector. But then there is like pure technological fintech firms that don't deal with kind of like maybe with asset management and stuff like that. And those wouldn't be kind of considered as a shadow bank. So it could be used like, this is a very good point, because what you can actually do is we have this typology. So you can also make a typology where here would be shadow banks and here would be fintech firms. And then you could kind of like, have shadow banks that are not fintech firms, shadow banks that are fintech firms, fintech firms that are not shadow banks and banks that are neither, how would I say, shadow banks or fintech firms.
Yeah, exactly. That is the reason why I wanted to raise the question here, actually, because this is actually the figure that gives an answer for this.
Yeah, question. Yeah. So that's that. But that was a really good question. Thank you for that.
Thanks.
So let's continue here, because it's also kind of like important to a little bit pause and think what actually innovation can be. And there is this kind of topology where you have this kind of like, we very often think about innovation as both being very transformational, which means that it totally transforms the market. And by such, it's also like very disruptive to the players that are already in the market. There can be different kind of, there can be also kind of like incremental innovation, which means that you just kind of tweak the product or introduce new features, new innovative features into the product. And it can also be kind of disruptive, but there can be innovation that are sustaining. And sustaining innovation in this top typology means that you try to do something that focuses on kind of building your position in the market to kind of either prematurely defend yourself against possible new players, or kind of keeping the kind of like your customers to yourself, and that can also be kind of like incremental, or then it can be transformational. It can be kind of like sustaining, then again kind of like really something new. This would be then this kind of transformational innovation would have a significant technical change, and here modest. But so we easily only look at this like Tesla or like iPhone or something. But here can also be kind of like a Google that you can do the Google search by taking a picture, which is at least to me it was a new feature. So you just point and do the picture, and it looks like what would be the product inside, or what would you want to information about, and then it gives, or other kind of type, which is like kind of incremental, and it sustains me as a Google user, and it's an innovation. When this kind of financial innovation emerged, and when these first fintech firms came to the market, there was a big kind of like worriness in the incumbent industry that now there's going to be this huge disruption in the financial services. We're going to, all these banks are going to disappear and what they were really afraid was that they understood that because of these earlier characteristics, the financial sector services had been a poor innovation, and these new competitors, they focused on a very narrow range where they tried to kind of increase the customer's value a lot. They were very lean. Usually these financial service sector firms had a lot of like legacy systems and very kind of like big processes, and very kind of old technology emphasized IT approaches where, they were really lean and they had a strong economies of scale. And then there was kind of like various players. A lot of financial sector firms were very worried about Google and Apple, which they should have been, of course. And then also the startup emerging. And then many of them saw that these traditional companies also had early movers who were trying to become digital very fast. And one of the kind of like, difference was, for example, that there was this kind of local, perhaps like, more of like not kind of share ownership type of banks, where they first were quite you know, they were quite hesitant to kind of change, and then there was like this kind of more kind of firm-based, like business lending-based firms that banks that kind of took this digital initiative much more rapidly. So there's this World Economy Forum, as you know, which is in Davos, and they published a large study on the financial innovation and what is like the landscape, what can be kind of like kind of what can be deducted from the trends that we observe in the market already. And these are the kind of like highlights of that report. And they argue that actually now the innovation in financial services is actually deliberate and predictable, which it used it when it started, it wasn't the case. There was like kind of like there wasn't this view that this is going to be mainly driven by these fintech firms, and the kind of like there was a discussion whether these are just one-time kind of improvements in the value chain, where the there wouldn't be like this kind of like all-around transformative nature. But now, you know, the view is that, yeah, there's going to be a change, and where it's going to hit these incumbent players where there's a like greatest source of customer friction, where the customers are the most unhappy about the offerings, and where of course there's largest profit pools that can be tapped into, which of course makes sense. And they have a kind of like the where this kind of impact comes from are from the business models that usually these fintech firms have that are platform based. They are data intensive, and also they don't require a lot of capital, which is not the case with these kind of banks, which are very capital heavy because of the regulation. And they argue that this disruption is felt first in banking sector, which actually is the case. You can see that there's a lot of things happening, especially in the kind of payment side. But this WEF report argues that the greatest impact will in fact be in insurance sector, because of this kind of new ways of kind of, by the enlarging this insurability we discussed, by kind of like the possibility to calculate, different risks, to model all kinds of like tangible risks and stuff like that. So that would be the one that in the long run would face the biggest changes. And this is interesting point, and we will come here that there has been actually a change how kind of existing banks and other financial institutions actually see these fintech firms, and in some cases they compete with them head-to-head, but there's also a lot of like research and development efforts going along at the moment, and we will discuss a little bit about it in the upcoming hour. And then, which is quite evident, is that of course the whole industry will change, the risk profile of the whole industry will change, and this is important because this has a direct impact on regulation, because what the regulation tries to do is it tries to prevent these risks happening, and they have certain idea of what the kind of risks are and what their distributions are and how likely they are and what the kind of the size when if the risk materializes. And now that if risk profiles change rapidly and take a lot of new forms, there can, it is a valid question, how does the regulation kind of change its approach if the underlying risk changes? Are they kind of lean enough as a kind of public entities to kind of address these new risks so that there won't be anything like major happening because that the risk profiles didn't match the risks at hand? And one thing is also that that although this we focus very much in the present and we see that the technological development is quite rapid from our perspective, this disruption, especially when it kind of hits the insurance sector, where usually the kind of contracts and liabilities can be very long, this disruption will be a long process. So those were the kind of like the key points looking at what has happened now and just like to see the roadmap for the future and also taking it a little bit back from the banking sector and enlarging it to the financial sector as large. We have this kind of, you know, different areas where the most relevant for our discussion is of course, deposits and lending, and also kind of like payments and maybe, you know, this kind of investment management. So we have this kind of already the emergence of these alternative lending sites, which we will discuss more than about, you know, the kind of drive to mobility, which is happening. And therefore this kind of, for example, in EU opening, the APIs for the bank accounts, being able to kind of build offering there. And of course, then this kind of like, cashless kind of payment systems, cryptocurrencies, you know, mobile money, this all these emerging kind of payment systems that disrupt the current offering a lot. And of course, then there is this kind of investment management where you kind of like give more information, you process, you have very good algorithm, you have all kinds of new ways of kind of manage investment. Of course, then there's this crowdfunding and new kind of platforms, all this data related, you know, fast, you know, processing artificial intelligence. And then in this insurance, you have this kind of this asset aggregation and connected insurance. So definitely there's like a lot of happening in here. So let's go to the fintech then. Do you have any questions of the kind of like the innovation part? If not, let's go to the fintech. So, the fintech's key forces are, of course, the technology, the process disruption, and the services transformation. And these are kind of like the sixth. This feeds into the kind of like to the financial innovation, but now that we go to like, how do we build business models on these, which usually is the kind of, you could say the startup is a kind of entity in search of a business model. So I mean like sustainable business model. So then we can look at this kind of like, what are these fintech as a startup potential for disruption and where lots of things is happening. So we have these payments as we discussed, then we have this kind of platform as a marketplaces and all kinds of like a payment market making facilities like Klarna and everything having to do with these marketplaces. Then there's a real estate, there's this kind of estate tech, especially in United States, where you have a kind of very advanced kind of real estate and mortgage based offerings in a kind of in fintech. You have the RegTech I talked about, you know, the kind of how to make it easier for the companies to fill out the reporting requirements and how to make it less burdensome. Then, you know, the business models as a, you know, about kind of like peer-to-peer lending and crowdfunding and this. And then, of course, this insurance and risk management type of innovations. Well, we discussed this in the on the kind of like from the categorization of World Economic Forum, but European Banking Authority has also kind of made a list of kind of important areas for the fintechs. And here the view is on the kind of the kind of like corporate side, the kind of like the kind of startup side of them, and basically they are the mainly the same. Well, if we look at the kind of challenges to the incumbent banks in Europe, definitely this kind of payment system, which is kind of like manifested in Apple Pay, for example, or this kind of Klarna type of like payment services connected to different kind of platforms where you can buy or through the kind of web-based purchasing, and one of the main enablers for this is not about the Apple Pay, which doesn't leverage this, but there's like a lot of development connected with this kind of open banking interface, which is a requirement that if you give a consent, then a third party can access your account information and offer services into it. And that's kind of like there's a lot of things happening there. But actually, there hasn't been that much kind of like take up yet. Then there's this kind of third-party documentation and digitalization of all other kind of documentation related to the kind of banks lending and everything. And just to give you an idea, is that as you know this kind of real estate documentation that is in digital forms make it very easy to kind of to have a kind of digital mortgage lending, for example, in Finland. It used to take a lot of time to kind of come up with these papers and to verify them and everything. And now, that offers a big improvements in efficiency. We already have touched about the cryptocurrencies, and it seems that it's now like after this pandemic, it has really kind of recently we see this kind of price ceilings on Bitcoin, for example, going through the roof. A lot of kind of companies, even the central banks, kind of looking at the possibilities of having this kind of like official cryptocurrencies. And this, of course, has to do with the blockchain, which is the underlying technology. But of course, this blockchain also kind of like makes it possible to decentralize clearing, which means that it basically becomes possible to make contracts and enforce them without the kind of central clarifying organization, which is what a lot of banks have been kind of doing. And then, of course, there's artificial intelligence. There are all kinds of bots that kind of challenge. No, I don't have this kind of corona figures here, but there's a lot of funding going into this sector, and there's a kind of all kinds of consulting firms looking at this. But what's kind of important here is that we actually don't have a very clear understanding how much of research and development is actually purchased by the banks themselves. So when we talk that lots of funding goes to the fintech, we only kind of look at how much funding has been allocated through private equity, to kind of to these fintech firms. But is this huge amount, if we compare it to the how much banks themselves kind of use the funds to do that? That's not clear. it has to do with the how this kind of research and development costs are kind of recorded. So this could be a lot, or it could be, you know, moderate. But definitely, whether it's moderate or a lot, it's a sizable figure. And it usually means that if you pour money into something, there's something definitely coming out of it. Usually, it's just a kind of rule of the law that, you know, you engage a lot of people coming up with something, they will come up with something. It might be something different that you expected, but definitely when you, you know, use resources, you tend to come up with something. And that's kind of like the indication that there's a lot of, you know, money going into these activities. Most of them will fail, but some won't. And some of these might be quite disruptive and transformative. What is also interesting is that, and this shows the kind of like, this is the Cambridge University has the Center for Alternative Finance. And I would really recommend you to visit that. They have a lot of different kind of information and research done on kind of fintech and also other kind of financial innovation areas. But one of kind of interesting is this that where is this kind of fintech activity? Where is it located? And we can see that most of the activity happening now is in Asia and especially in China. So you have major sites there. You have, of course, San Francisco and New York. But if you look at, for example, Europe, only London is among like the first. No, well, there's a Paris in 15th, but like one in almost 20. You can also see from kind of Finnish point of view that Finland, well, clearly they have the map right, but there is no kind of fintech activity here. And Stockholm is in the 17th place. Why this is important from like European and also maybe the kind of North American view is that most of our researchers, like Juha-Pekka, and I don't know whether you know Chinese, but I don't, but I assume you don't. It's very difficult to kind of follow the developments. There's like a lot of happening. It's happening in non-English, non-European languages. Sometimes, and in many cases, they are not published in English. So we kind of have a disadvantage because the rapid development is happening there, and we really then don't know, what the kind of state of the frontier is. But that's our kind of problem. But definitely, the emphasis of the innovative frontier is not laying in Europe. It might be laying in North America to some extent, but clearly it's in Asia. Well, crowdfunding is an area that held a lot of promise in the sense of disrupting the normal business activity of the banks, which were actually, transferring, surplus funds to the sectors that required. That lacked funds, and there was a lot of expectations that these crowdfunding platforms would somehow supplant the banks, but actually that hasn't happened. Some financial institutions, some banks even went as far as that they kind of established their own crowdfunding sites. I think we still have one in OP, but for example, Nordea kind of killed it, and I think the Rabobank in Netherlands is still having one. But what has happened is that these crowdfunding platforms have turned to be funding sites for those projects and those business ideas that don't get funding from the traditional funders. So if you have a good idea, you probably get funding from the already traditional banks. So there is definitely this adverse selection problem, which leads that only the most risky projects are here, and that has, of course, then the selection that not a lot of people that are not very risk-loving are there. So the crowdfunding in that sense have kind of lost its momentum. There's also this problem that some of these crowdfunding sites, as well as the peer-to-peer lending sites, has led to a crisis. We have a Prosper in United States that had a lot of problems emerging. There's definitely kind of like retreatment from here, but it doesn't mean that in the future, if some of these aspects that have now been problematic, that they are not resolved by some kind of financial innovation or something, that these will become more kind of relevant. But there is issues that cause concern. Well, we could have a kind of a very long discussion about blockchain and cryptocurrencies in here, and maybe some of you would have wanted more, but I'm going to kind of like not talk a lot about these, although they at the moment are like the kind of the trendiest part of this kind of evolving landscape. I just to kind of, as I already said, this blockchain as a technology, it means it's possible to kind of decentralize trust by kind of distributing this ledger. Ledger means who there is a record who owns who, what is the kind of like, what kind of contracts has been made, so you can clear if the, for example, the ownership or something changes hand, then you record it somewhere. And the clearing agent says, okay, this guy used to own this, now this guy owns it. So you can kind of like unevocally kind of be certain that all the rights and obligations related to a certain item or contract is kind of like true. So that's kind of was and still is the promise of blockchain. And clearly, as I mentioned, a lot of financial services companies have formed kind of research and development kind of partnerships that are doing work on developing things connected with the blockchain. Now, one of the major problems with this blockchain as a technology is that it's very computer processive intensive, which means that it's very difficult to kind of like to have the speed needed, for example, for the kind of widespread use of these technologies. So there's a number of problems here. Makes it a little bit kind of like possible that this kind of blockchain and cryptocurrencies faced a similar kind of humpy thing as these peer-to-peer lending and crowdfunding platforms have, that there's a great enthusiasm, then the problems show up and then the interest goes down. Now, one of it is that if you have a kind of this anonymous distributed ledger system where you don't know who the market participants are, it's, as I said, it's very computer processing intensive to find that, to create that blockchain and to record it and to verify it in order to have it. And if we kind of like would imagine that this blockchain-based payment system would be introduced, still it's the volume of this kind of verification is wide slower than, for example, the normal kind of credit card companies can achieve. So if like Visa or Eurocard or MasterCard can process like millions in a kind of second, then this kind of blockchain based is like maybe 10,000, or of course it depends on the capacity, and that makes it problematic. However, if you know who the market participants, if it's so-called closed blockchain where you know the participants or the number of participants is limited, then this kind of requirement for verification goes down dramatically. So there is this kind of like possibility to go into that direction. And you know about this, that this kind of blockchain-based and technologies also have this climate change kind of concern, that we will talk about the climate change and finance sector, because these are so energy intensive, in a sense that because it's so computational power intensive, it takes a lot of energy to do this kind of blockchain based verification. So it's not, in a sense, environmentally very sound system. Those were the observations. We will go to this kind of climate change thing, but one thing that I want to propose to you is that if we look at the kind of incumbent banks and their kind of possibilities to counteract this kind of big tech financial sector innovation strategies, and this big tech would then mean Google and Alibaba and Apple and everything. So these incumbent banks can kind of like compete or cooperate or actually become like service providers. Well, then they can go to try to kind of make themselves certain kind of platforms, what the kind of big tech strategies in many cases are, and they have a certain advantages, but of course then big tech companies can also kind of become intermediaries and offer these marketplace services and subsidize different types of things. But this is not easy. We see actually that, well, Apple Pay, for example, has been quite successful in Europe, but there is now indications that it's not very very kind of it hasn't kind of attracted attention in United States, which is actually United States is in this kind of payment system. It's kind of lacking behind Europe. So Apple Pay, for example, is much more kind of like stronger in Europe than it's in the United States. Google, for example, launched already like 5 years ago an insurance site. They wanted to kind of challenge insurance companies, and they came with the auto insurance comparison site, which they then killed quite rapidly. As you know, Google is famous for kind of getting a lot of ideas into market and then killing them quickly if they don't work out. So for example, Google's inroad to insurance wasn't successful, although everybody was kind of very worried about it, because they would have a kind of lot of information about the kind of like based on their search on the kind of these customers' profiles. I think this is a good kind of overall picture. It comes from Comber, where they have tried to kind of look at the kind of divide these different fintech offerings into kind of this is actually, we should have actually looked at this directly after the similar picture where there was like disruptive and transformative and new markets existing, because this kind of echoes in a certain way that I actually have to do it if I get the third chance to give these lectures. But here you can see that there's the kind of disruptive effect, and then there's this complementary, which would be kind of transformative. I mean, that kind of support, preventive, supportive way. And then there's kind of like the idea that what of these products will kind of enhance or just supplement. So you have this kind of like, for example, here the blockchain would be definitely new products, new services, but this kind of open banking interface would be more kind of this kind of incremental type of offering from the fintech firms. Okay, this is also in relationship to the question that was asked about what are the kind of non-shadow banking fintech firms. And here is a topology that has been proposed by Deloitte in the report, where you have a kind of like incumbent service providers, and they are like this kind of that leverage fintech. Then there is that kind of technology providers, and then there is that kind of pure play fintechs. And given this, you can kind of look which are kind of shadow bank related, which are kind of incumbent related. Okay, so one of the ideas I want to propose to you is that as there is like banks, and then there is those that are directly involved in financial markets. We saw that like smaller companies and medium companies and households usually need to kind of work through banks, and then there is certain companies that can access kind of financial markets directly because of their characteristics. So we can also have here kind of like, it's not one way or another. It's not on off. It probably will lead to a situation where there is a complementary and overlapping and kind of competition to cooperation type of arrangements between like these big banks, these big tech companies, and then these fintech companies. And here is like an idea that where the Red Cross is disadvantaged. So for example, big tech and fintech have a competitive advantage on technological use, which big banks lack. But then again, big banks have, very good, customer databases. They have already the existing customers. They can kind of leverage the network effects. They probably have an advantage in funding their operations, which fintech and big tech firms lack. So you have this kind of like very mixed and versatile and way of looking at the kind of the future of the financial services industry. This also highlights the kind of like advantages and disadvantages these fintech firms have, and here you can also have the disadvantages, which I will perhaps now concentrate, because we are a lot of talking about the advantages and how they kind of like take over and make it very easy for fintech firms to kind of challenge banks. That this customer base is very important, especially if we have a kind of very tough data protection legislation. Then if you have a customer base, you are clearly in advantage because it's very difficult to kind of find the proper customers and target them in the case that the access to your personal data is limited. And then we talked about this relationship banking. So this also, although it's kind of like this fintech and fintech and this kind of digitalization of the data and emergence of big data has made it less relevant, it still is relevant in to certain aspect. And clearly, by having this relationship banking, these banks have this access to soft information, which clearly the fintechs don't have. And even if they would want it, it would be very cost to kind of build a network that collects this soft information. And the cost of capital, and of course the, you know, the very young nature of these fintech firms make it very difficult to fintech firms to kind of challenge the banks. So what has actually happened is that the first problem that emerged when financial innovation really kind of took hold of the financial service sector and these fintech firms were created and started to kind of being seen as a threat to the traditional banking sector. The banks, as I said, were really kind of worried. But what has happened is that now they actually have seen that they are much more resilient to changes these old banks and other financial sector companies. And actually, the way has become more of seeing fintech firms as a threat to as a possibility to kind of try out new ideas, to outsource research and development efforts. And this actually has been a blessing, perhaps, to the industry in a sense that it used to be, as I said, it's costly and very risk to have a lot of research and development, but it's a great idea, a great opportunity for big banks and insurance companies, you know, to engage these fintech firms, offer them all kinds of facilities and kind of like you know, cooperative funding, small scale, and look which of those really take off. And then you have the possibility to either buy those fintech firms or somehow to incorporate them into your own offering. So what this means is that actually by teaming up with these fintechs, the major financial service companies and banks have outsourced their research and development. And I don't know how kind of ethically sound it is, but you know, they can be certain that there's a lot of these very enthusiastic you know, startup people in these small fintech firms coming up, doing a lot of hours, you know, for very low pay, you know, coming up with ideas, trying them, failing, which these banks don't need to take care about. And then if there is some good idea coming out that they feel that this is something that would really improve their offering, as I said, they would just kind of buy it for themselves. So somehow leverage the technology or the business that has been generated in there. So this actually has happened even in Finland, where you have a kind of like different type of collaboration terms. And here you can see that there is like Nordea, Osuuspankki and Danske, which are the biggest Finnish banks. And there's also these insurance companies. So Nordea, for example, has this Nordea Ventures. There's OP Lab Innovation Unit. It's all kinds of accelerators like Runaway, Nestholm, Nordea is teaming up with. It's a kind of collaboration. The Danske Bank has foreign hub partnerships. And there is this direct then that they have felt that this is a good kind of idea. So then they have made a kind of like direct investments. In this case, like, you know, you have this mobile pay by Danske that was created in one of the fintech firms. They have, you have all this other type of stuff. So definitely there is a kind of like more seeing the fintech as not as a kind of threat, but the possibility for kind of very cheap and successful research in development. So the kind of it has really changed from the beginning, where they were seeing those as a big threat. Well, what is uptake for this kind of fintechs from this? The problem is that as they are in a very small operations usually, then individual risks become very important because you really can't diversify. So you have very much higher risk profile. And usually when you have very kind of narrow area of operation in financial services space, you tend to have these interacting and accumulating risks. And by making this offer very narrow, you have this kind of leaniness and very directive thing. But then you also, of course, introduce this adverse selection and moral hazard risks, which basically, by being a bigger player, you can, to the certain extent, avoid because of the kind of the portfolio effects. This, of course, then means that, you know, you need to spend a lot of time and making the monitoring and screening processes kind of like efficient. And by being kind of small player in the kind of innovative kind of frontier and having to face with a lot of kind of tail risks, you have the kind of problem of if there comes a black swans, what happens. And this is also the case with Corona, which when it emerged, it basically took away a lot of funding for these fintechs, not only fintechs, but startup companies in total, which has now, when then the money started to pour in because of the quantitative easing, then it again kind of like speeded up, and there was again a lot of kind of money looking for returns with perhaps higher risk profile. But there was definitely kind of drying up the funds, and then again kind of like reemergence of funds. So you have a very big problems with the kind of viability in this kind of environment. And, you know, as a kind of financial services, potential financial services customer, it's a risky also for the customers to engage with these kind of fintechs that have these risks. And of course, the problem here is how to break even. You have many years you have to have just pure equity funding because you make a lot of losses. And then perhaps if you find that, if you validate your business model, or if you can pivot it to the way that it starts kind of earning, and then how to kind of scale it up fast. And only like after a long time, after burning a lot of kind of money, investor money, you can kind of start breaking even. Of course, then those that really succeed, they break even in a kind of very lucrative way. So this was about the kind of financial innovation and fintech firms. Now we actually go, before we go to the regulation, I was thinking that I would have a few words about the climate change, because there's also a hope that this would be an area where there would be a fintech innovation. And there's some promising openings in that space. But do you have a comment or question about that fintech side?
No, nothing there. So carry on.
Okay, so let's go to the climate change. Now, banks have a big impact on these carbon emissions. Why? The way you fund the industries that generate a lot of emissions is usually very capital intensive. So you have these main sources, which are electricity and heat. Then there is the kind of steel, concrete, mining. I have actually forgotten from this, of course, oil. And all these industries require a lot of capital. And of course, like direct finance, but also banks have a lot of money tied up into these activities. Now, if you have a lending portfolio that has heavy reliance on carbon generating business processes and models, in today's environment where customers and governments are really looking at these CO2 emissions and how to combat climate change, it increases these lenders' risks. So also you have the market-based risks where, you know, you have consumers changing for example, to use hybrid or electric cars, and then the oil companies and petrol distributional companies, of course, will lose customers, and the risks involved, just to give an example, are increased there. Now, that's not all. That's the market response, the shifting consumers kind of attitude, and also, of course, the kind of pressure groups and like that. But then also the governments have realized the need, and this realization has led that central banks are now kind of considering that it used to be the case that these capital requirements were based on kind of traditional risks of not kind of paying back and everything. But now there is kind of discussion and probably coming up a need for taking these environmental risks into the capital requirements. So if you are heavily lending on the kind of activities that generate a lot of carbon emissions, you will have to have more capital. So this is a threat, and even just this threat has led to the realization that something needs to be done. And so, for example, Nordea now, just in February, told that they will reduce the kind of the emissions from both the investment portfolio and this business lending portfolio by half. And then similar type of pledges has been done by Bank of America, JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley, which are the biggest kind of private banks in United States. So clearly, like, banks have realized it, and not only the customers, but also this kind of like threat of these risks feeding into the kind of capital requirements have fueled the transition that the banks are doing at the moment. Now, there's not a lot of kind of scientific literature and research on a kind of like financial sectors exposure. But one is what I would recommend is the European Central Bank has published in just May 2021 a kind of working paper where they looked at do banks fuel climate change, where they look at this kind of banks lending and how that has affected. So that's a really good paper, and from that they have actually done calculations where they have tried to look at the kind of what is the exposure of different financial sector actors to that kind of like climate relevant sector, which would be kind of like fossil fuels and energy intensive, industries and housing and transport and everything. And you can see here the equity exposure, which is quite huge. And you have this kind of investment funds all around across the world have like over, maybe half, I don't know, this finance should kind of, they calculate that the finance has risk because it finances these activities, but I don't know whether that's kind of like a little bit kind of taking it too far, but you can see here almost half, then the industrial companies have a lot of exposure. Pension funds, here are the banks, and then the individual governments and other credit institutions are less. But definitely there is this kind of problem. But one of the major problems here has been that there is not agreed disclosure and measurement processes that have been agreed by all parties. How to kind of look at these climate risks in the kind of financing activities. So this Financial Stability Board, which is like pan-governmental organization, has now a task force that has kind of like suggested this climate-related disclosures. And also EU has kind of guidelines, which are based partly on this Financial Stability Board's kind of recommendations, how you kind of like report this climate-related information. And there's a financial sector-led partnership, private one, where they are trying to build carbon accounting financial, which would have this kind of information that everybody would agree on, and everybody would kind of share that this is the kind of a way to make them comparable, and also then of course based some reduction measurements in there. This Regesa's paper, which I already mentioned, actually has, as I said, there's a little econometric work done, looks at the kind of regulatory effects on the kind of the that actually to put in the in a kind of sense, it says that there was this kind of gas emissions in United States that were enacted in law by Trump, and then that actually led that these banks reduced their lending to these most affected industries. So definitely there was kind of like withdrawal of funding from those industries that were termed to be kind of heavily exposed to that. So by regulating it, the effect was that the banks kind of like changed their lending policies, and thus regulation had a positive effect on the kind of climate change because it made it difficult and had to kind of put the more pressure on those industries to become more climate friendly. So with the climate change and there is the problem of how to measure it, how to measure the exposure of financial sector. Clearly, there is an understanding that this is a major issue. The industry itself independently is doing stuff to decrease the exposure, but also this government-led policies, and especially the threat of incorporating this climate risk into the equity requirements, solvency requirements, capital requirements of the banks and financial sector has a kind of big motivating force to do that. There's also a lot of kind of startup and fintech activity having to do with this kind of climate change, not only with this RegTech, which would be how to kind of operationalize and how to make this kind of the reporting easier, but there's also a kind of like carbon kind of permit trade type of fintech companies forming. Like there's the possibility to start kind of compensating carbon leakages from your purchasing, and that's something that, you know, financial sector companies can leverage. So when you do the payment, for example, for a certain product, you can pay at the same time compensation for the emissions that this product or service you use generates. So those would be very promising areas for that. So these were the few notes about the climate change and yeah.
Oh, there's actually a now very good question for you from Celia. Yes. She would like to know that what's your idea about the how will the European Union green taxonomy affect the banking sector?
It will. There is a kind of like there is a already a, it will take some time, because what the kind of EU does is that they have this kind of taxonomy, and then they will actually implement them in a national legislation and guidelines, and then it becomes force. This taxonomy, to my understanding, is binding in a sense that once you kind of take it you can't have like different areas, but you have to also remember that there is areas here that it doesn't cover. So for example, Finland has a kind of like kept certain areas of this kind of regulation outside the kind of EU jurisdictions. For example, like most of the decisions made in about the forest use, which is a big carbon sink, is actually still kept in Finland, and Finland is very reluctant to kind of go and kind of let the kind of European wide decisions on the forest sector to kind of affect Finland. So it will have an impact, and it will be because of the banks will start by themselves also kind of adhering to these standards, but it will take some time. So is that, was that like, that's kind of my view. Do you have any, how do you see yourself the possibility for that?
Celia, are you satisfied with Olli-Pekka's answer? Yeah, she's satisfied. So continue.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. Yeah. This is a very interesting area, and I bet that if you want to do your master thesis or something, JP will be more than happy. Happy to kind of like take those as a kind of. There's a lot of need for new information about this, so. So definitely. So so now to kind of, to wrap up all this, regulation is very important in financial sector. And this is because financial service sectors are definitely more risk prone than other type of industries. And here it is that actually the whole idea is this kind of like managing risk, and that drives the riskiness of different activities drive the requirements for capital, and not like in the kind of, if you have a manufacturing industry where you have a certain capital, what you invest in certain kind of, facilities and processes, and those processes themselves then create the risks. So this goes a little bit kind of untypically, and that's why, the capital is kind of derivative from the risk, and not that the risk is derivative from the capital. And therefore, the required capital, there's also the problem that this required capital and its quality is hard to define. And we talked earlier about the need for like suitable collateral material to kind of facilitate financing. And there's actually calculations that, how much like safe assets an economy needs in order to kind of this collateral-based kind of financing, to work properly. And the shadow banking has actually been part of the solution, but that certainly couldn't be termed as a safe capital. So there is a lot of kind of fuzziness of about quality of kind of capital in the kind of system, and many times because of the leverage and the structure of the trades, the losses can be incurred and can be far greater than the capital available. A lot of like famous historical cases where one trader has kind of resulted a collapse of a whole financial institution. And so even if you have capital, you can engage in such a risk, so huge risks that it can wipe everything out and even more. And then this kind of like, as we are more and more integrated and as the globalization has kind of processed, there's the systemic elements, like the emergent unknowable elements have become more pronounced, which, some use the word black holes or black swans. Black hole is actually a liquidity thing, as black swan is like the kind of major kind of unexpected thing. So that's, if you wonder why there's no black swan, this is about the liquidity. And then the global banks, can be bigger than their host countries. When the financial crisis of 2008 materialized, UBS in Switzerland, their biggest bank was had assets that were three times the GDP of Switzerland. So we talk about like huge financial entities. So you can have an Nordea, which is now located in Finland. It changed its kind of location from Sweden to Finland. Now is like huge, represent a huge risk and challenge to Finnish financial authorities. Now, interestingly, there is also a kind of discussion that should banks be regulated at all. Now we just heard about me arguing how they are very risky and can cause a lot of trouble. But then again, there is this kind of argument that, it's very costly to regulate. It has been estimated that this Basel costs about 3.5% annually for US banks. And there's some very high figures about the UK banks of the whole regulatory burden. And it's also kind of not only the kind of regulatory costs and the kind of the cost of excess capital. It's also like the kind of costs with IT systems and doing the reporting, fulfilling the reporting requirements. And then there is this question about, does this regulation actually decrease this innovation? We talked about it earlier. And there is like, you know, the competition is lessened because it's more costly to enter the banking sector, because there is like minimum capital requirements, and there is certainly a expense on having this kind of financial reporting systems. And this will, of course, then, because it has to be financed by something, you have a kind of a increase in interest rate spreads, which leads to a welfare loss. So this can be kind of put on the downside of this regulation. But one of the major kind of criticism has been that we have had this regulation for a long time, and still we have banking crisis. So regulators have not been very successful in averting banking crisis. Of course, this is very hard to verify because we don't have a counterfactual evidence of a banking system that hasn't been regulated. But still, there has been banking crisis. It might have that without the regulation, there would have been like multiple times more these banking crises. But it certainly hasn't kind of like freed the industry from that. And then there is, of course, the question that that if, like, for example, payment system and basic kind of banking facilities are under risks in a kind of multi-product, multifunctional financial institution that have investment banks and business lending, and then there is this poor kind of pensioners, small deposits there, should actually government own banks, in a sense that should they have the kind of, should they offer kind of basic banking services and then just kind of let these risky business-related things to be taken care of by the markets. And as you know, in many cases, banks and insurance companies were nationalized in previous times, not so long a time ago. And we have, for example, still in Japan, the Post Bank that in Finland also used to have a kind of big role, has, I think, almost quarter of the deposits, which is like, you know, you have this kind of like government-owned entity still kind of working there. I would like to highlight you this with this kind of Frexes and Rosets framework for regulation, which also talks about that you have to have the market failure, and then you have this regulation, and then you kind of like these regulatory agents, which also have their own utility functions. They might have this kind of biased objectives. There is a discussion about the degree of independence. There is to talk about these revolving doors where the kind of industry players, hire these regulators. And when you know that you will be hired to a very high paying position in the bank, you kind of regulate. Perhaps in the future, if you don't make any trouble, then you kind of tend not to kind of regulate them so effectively. So there's all these kind of incentive problems there also. Most of the regulation of the financial system is, you know, you are restricted to enter. You have these fit and proper requirements, which means that if you have a criminal record or something, you cannot work in the bank, or if you don't have a kind of proper knowledge, which is now, for example, in case in Veritas insurance company, where this new proposed CEO is not fit and proper according to Finnish regulatory authority. That's just an example from the insurance sector. And then you have these minimal capital requirements, which really are quite heavy. You have these restrictions on where to invest and how much, and how you have to kind of like manage these, and how much information you need to disclose. And of course, there's this deposit insurance with. Due to because of the time, I don't go to this political economy, but I just, you know, kind of like mentioned that, you know, there is this regulatory capture, which means that, you know, there is evidence that those kind of industries that are very concentrated and where this regulation has a big impact on profitability and where there's this information asymmetries and the regulation is complex, they tend to be, you know, the government officials tend to be certain in a certain way kind of captured by the industry that they are supposed to regulate. And there is actually even empirical evidence on this kind of like private interest. So it's not that kind of like clear cut. However, you know, I'm personally, of course, in favor of regulation, but I just wanted to kind of highlight to you that this is not the kind of like generally accepted. You know, you can argue that why regulate something. If we look at the regulation and innovation, which is a kind of challenge to financial sector regulators, you tend to kind of have idea that you should be able to at least have a certain amount of experimental space. However, how to do it? There is this kind of shortlist by Lumpkin, how the regulator should kind of adapt their regulatory activities to kind of enable at least some type of financial innovation. And what has actually happened in the fintech space is that you know, European regulators encourage a kind of you know, development, but they want that it's kind of there is an oversight, and these consumer protection issues are the biggest driver for this regulation. And now there is this kind of open banking you know, regulation and all the other kind of like legislation that either makes it easier to innovate or then makes it more difficult. And more difficult, I would like to highlight this anti-money laundering legislation, which actually makes it very difficult to kind of have very innovative things because innovative openings in a kind of payment process system because, you know, you have to know where the funds come from and who they are. And so this is a kind of like for the payment system, this anti-money laundering legislation is of course hindrance, but you have to have it so the criminals can't launder their money. So then there is the question that should these fintechs be regulated like banks or some other entities? And this is a very good question. For example, the Finnish Financial Sector Trade Association doesn't accept fintech firms as their members. So they have precluded them from their membership. So the fintech firms have their own trade association, Fintech Finland. And they have some cooperation, but definitely like at least banks argue that these are totally different type of businesses and there should be a clear kind of boundary between them. Finnish Financial Services Authority have established this kind of fintech hotlines and help desks and the Finns are not the only ones. So there is clearly kind of like at least some initiatives to help fintechs and you can call them and ask about like regulation to kind of map out whether, you know, your startup idea in the field of fintech, does it have any possibilities to kind of operate given the current regulatory system. And then in UK, for example, they have established this kind of regulatory sandboxes, which means that some of these fintech firms don't need to comply with all the regulatory requirements. So they have like a playing ground where they can experiment. There's some initiatives there, but I don't know whether they will kind of like when they, what will be the outcome. But they are clearly giving some room for that. Just to kind of close up, there is a kind of lot of development in the regulation, and there's also regulatory challenges. Not only I have had a very, unfortunately, very European and North American view, but we have this kind of questions, you know, having to do with China, India, other kind of emerging markets that, you know, will, you know, kind of change the regulatory framework in the future. So definitely those are the areas also that one should kind of have an eye upon. And the last to close up, I would also kind of like to share you a viewpoint where some of the researchers are arguing that given the 2008 financial crisis, given the heavy burden of regulation, and giving the inherent risks of the banking sector, will the future of the banks actually be like utilities, electric generating utilities, gas utilities? So they will become like quasi-public in a sense that they have such a small room for maneuvering and such a kind of punishment for innovation that you have this kind of like, you know, very stable, very kind of, you know, monotonic, you know, industry. I hope not. I hope that this fintech and financial innovation will transform banks to kind of like, and the regulators will realize the need for this to new kind of like entities offering new services to customers and enhancing the customers' well-being and also facilitating the growth of an economy in the future. So this was actually what I wanted to share with you. Thanks. We are 4 minutes over time. I'm sorry for that. But if you have any questions or comments, you know, please, I would be more willing to kind of answer them and discuss something more. Thanks, Juha-Pekka, once again.
Thanks once again, Olli-Pekka, for giving really, really good overview of the things that you are an expert on. So are there any questions in the audience? I have one question to you as a colleague. What's your personal opinion regarding this last slide where you actually raised up a really relevant possibility for the future of the banks as quasi-public utilities? Will the central bank digital currencies actually introduce this avenue?
Yeah, I think that's one of the kind of like enabling factor for this change. And one thing is also that remember the Liikanen report when there was this, where the idea was that you'd separate this risk-taking, you know, risk-prone activities from the basic business. And we have this historical kind of like, we don't need to go that far to the history where, you know, most of the kind of household type of not lending and deposit taking was like in post office, it was in the, you know, kind of like mutual this kind of credit unions and coop, and they have now, of course, so there is a kind of like this trend that we could revert back to, and then if this kind of we go to the kind of digital economy where there is a kind of like intangible capital, which is very difficult to kind of estimate, which makes it very difficult to kind of have debt instruments because you have to have a collateral. So you go to this equity-based and everything. So basically, there could be even this, that you separate them, you have this kind of government owned. And look, even now, the kind of central bank has taken over the banking sector. They kind of buy the, you know, the debt instruments and keep like economy going. So they have actually bypassed the banks.
Yeah, I actually completely agree with you that we might be facing that actually in the quite near-term future, within, let's say, 5 or 10 years, that we are really seriously talking about the role of banks in that in that form, that way that we now have those. They might change much more towards these public utilities or something like that. And the central bank is the one that actually is deciding about that, and the authorities. Yeah.
Actually, Jeppe, let's make a paper on that.
Discuss and paper. Yeah, there's actually a lot of research going on. Like, for example, JME, Journal of Monetary Economics, is now doing lots of things about this. So it's it's really something that people are considering now. Thanks again. You actually raised a question there somewhere, that whether you would be able to give these lectures next year. Yes, you are. If you are, if you have the time to do that, because you are following also the markets quite closely, and we seem to share some ideas here. So I think that you are an obvious visitor for this course also next year.
It would be a pleasure.
But if there's no questions from the audience, then I would like to also thank, first of all, Olli-Pekka for a very nice presentation. This was a really good wrap-up of everything at the end of the course. And for the students, remember to submit your home assignments within the deadline and take the exam, that so you will be able to finish the course. I now move the ball to you. We have done our share, so it's up to you now to finish the course. Okay, thanks. I will stop now recording, and you can leave the scene. I would like to have some words.